Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we're going to be taking you deeper than ever into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. First up, some quick messages from our supporting partners, We Are One Composites and Wahoo. Wahoo Fitness are the ultimate companion for all your mountain biking challenges. In taking on the Enduro World Series, Stone King Rally and downhill racing, Wahoo has been my go-to brand for training, racing and riding. Their Kicker indoor trainer has been an absolute game changer, whether I'm getting those winter Zone 2 miles done or smashing out an interval session. With precision power and intensity control based on Wahoo's cutting-edge fitness tests like the full frontal 40p and half Monty ramp test, I know I'm always getting the most effective workouts possible. And with seamless connectivity to their system online training platform, tailored training plans are just a click away, perfectly aligned with my goals and schedule. But Wahoo isn't just about training. Their bike computers, the Element, Bolt and Roam, have become essential riding companions. They're robust and reliable, enabling me to track my rides and see my progress. With Wahoo's approach to continuous improvement via free software updates, it means they keep getting better. And now Wahoo is taking things to the next level with their biggest feature update yet. With Wahoo's latest integrations, you can control your music directly from your bike computer, and very soon you'll be able to do the exact same with your GoPro too. Imagine being able to start and stop your GoPro right from your bike computer to see if it's recording or not, so there's no more post-ride regrets when you realize you forgot to hit record. You'll even be able to change your GoPro mode and profile right there on your handlebars. Top work, Wahoo. Head over to wahoofitness.com now and discover how Wahoo can help you. Wheel on Wheels are awesome, there's no doubt about it. Engineered to perfection and built to the highest quality standards, We Are One hit that sweet spot between stiffness and compliance to create a ride that's precise and direct but not punishing to ride. I've been using We Are One's wheels for many years now with zero issues, and they've always remained tight and true without ever needing to show them a spoke key. With their latest convergence wheels, they've turned everything up to 11, managing to make an even stronger set of wheels that still give that incredible We Are One ride feel. We've got them on all of the downhill team bikes, and they performed flawlessly all year long. For the month of May, We Are One are offering Downtime listeners 20% off all wheel sets. So head over to wearonecomposites.com and use the code DOWNTIMEMAY20 at the checkout. That's Downtime with a capital D, May with a capital M and the number 20 with no spaces over at wearonecomposites.com until the end of May 2024. Okay, just a couple more quick things before we get stuck into this week's episode. First up, make sure you never miss an episode by following the podcast. Simply hit the follow button in your podcast app or find dedicated buttons for all the major platforms at downtimepodcast.com/follow. You can also keep up to date with what's going on by following us on Instagram or Facebook, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And if you're hungry for more downtime, then you can join the newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. If you want to support the show, then you can join our Patreon over at downtimepodcast.com/Patreon, or grab yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, if you prefer to watch today's episode, you can check out the podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast. I'd love it if you head over there, subscribe to the channel and show the videos some love via likes and comments. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode on the website downtimepodcast.com. All right, today we're joined by athlete, presenter and podcaster Andrew Neathling. We'll be diving into Andrew's remarkable journey from his professional career to the invaluable lessons he gleaned from his father shaping his path to success. Discover how Andrew navigated the challenges of reaching the top of his sport on a shoestring budget, and why a ride with the legend Travis Pastrana is a blur in his memory. And of course, we'll get Andrew's insider scoop on who to keep an eye on in the upcoming downhill race season. So without further ado, here's Andrew Neathling. Andrew Neathling, athlete, ambassador, commentator and fellow podcaster. You're a busy man, amongst other things as well, I think. Thanks for making some time to join us on the show. How's things?
Anytime, man. I'm honored to get an invite. I've followed your show for a long time, and it's part of the inspiration that a podcast was in the mountain bike industry. So that's pretty cool. Athlete, strong use of the word, but I did... I did clock some training yesterday, and I've done a test because I might end up at Mega Avalanche for a project, but I decided survival would mean I need to do a bit of training. Not to win, not to excel, but to survive 50 minutes with my little arms after taking such a long break of structured training would probably be a good idea. So yeah, nice. I can call myself an athlete again. That's pretty cool.
That's good. Have you done Mega Avalanche before?
I did back in the day. I've done the one in Alpe d'Huez. It was awesome. And then I also went to Reunion Island with a former teammate, Eric Carter.
Yeah.
We called ourselves a professional snorkeling team because all we did was practice and then straight to the sea, which we didn't know at the time. There was kind of a few warnings, or at least a year or two after, with shark attacks. But we were just driving down the freeway, or highway for me, freeway for the Yanks. And me and EC were like, let's just go jump in the ocean there and scuba a bit or snorkel. So mega avalanche I've done. I always say, I don't know how you think about it, but I think any core gravity-fed mountain biker should tick the mega avalanche off.
It's a pretty special event.
It is, right? There's just something about mass start downhill and the chaos that ensues, you know? And it's so different to downhill enduro where it's a time trial. This is sort of the complete opposite.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been as nervous as being on that start grid on the glacier at some ridiculous time in the morning with like French techno, helicopter flying above filming it. It was, like a wild experience. But equally, like, I think anyone could do it. It's not like super gnarly. It's just crazy, right?
Yes. People have seen the videos of the carnage on the glacier, and even the wife was like, I've seen those videos. Is this the smartest thing to do in your age, he likes to call it. I'm like, no, I mean, I'm pretty comfortable there to stay out of trouble. But I think, yeah, if you're conservative through the glacier, anyone could do it. It's kind of a downhill version of a cross-country race. If you feel like you want to pass the guy and you got more speed, try get past him if he lets you, or grab him on a flat or the uphill. But super unique event, and I do hope this project comes off so we get to go back.
Yeah, sweet man. I look forward to seeing how you get on. What test did you do yesterday then?
It was a gentleman I've connected with that you might know, Jamie Reed. We've just been chatting, and he is very fascinating guy. I don't want to butcher, but he's doing a PhD in what sounds like sort of performance in downhill and mountain biking. So I've connected him to another old coach of mine, Alan, and they've had crazy chats. So he's kind of not debunking, but we were chatting a lot about what I struggled with in the past in my racing, and how my body makeup and how I deal with lactic acid. And I said a few things, and he then said, well, to get a better idea, you got to do this test. So he said, okay, cool. So you got a power meter, you got a heart rate monitor. I said, Jamie, dude, I sold all that stuff. Like, that is a thing of the past. I haven't looked at a heart rate monitor in 8 years. I don't even have one, let alone these Wahoo smart kickers. So off I went and got one borrowed and got my Lycra on, and, you know, forgot to put a towel on the ground because I forgot you sweat so much indoors. And all we did was doing this sort of test that he can assess my body composition, and we go from there. But I'll definitely dig a bit deeper into it. I'm basically said, why don't I become a guinea pig so I have more knowledge? You know, I really was into it when I was training 8 years ago. You know, yeah. I was into wattage and all this and lactic this, and Alan Millward would be at the finish of the downhill, you know, and we got pretty high tech into it. But anyway, yeah, so yeah, back loosely training a bit.
Good on you, man. Good on you. Well, we'll talk a bit about training actually as we get through this, but like, I want to wind the clock back, as we do with most people the first time they come on the show, and just get some background. So just tell us a little bit about like growing up and how bikes come into your life, because I think we're a similar age where mountain bikes probably weren't around initially when we started to learn to ride bikes, but then probably came at a really good time when we were starting to discover hobbies and see other fun things to do with being outdoors.
Yeah, it was a very unique sport, especially in South Africa, access to equipment and, you know, even knowledge of the sport. And my late father and his sort of cycling crew, they did this famous road race called the Cape Argus. It's still, I think, the biggest one-day amateur road race. There's 35 to 40,000 participants, and you go off in different batches, right? So that was very popular. So my dad did a bunch of road riding, and our family friends were Erica Green at the time, now Groenewold, and her husband. Anyway, and the reason I bring that's the context. So she went to Olympics twice for cross country, and that's quite a feat to do as a South African, to make it, especially in cross country overseas. So he was mountain biking a bit on the weekends. And as kids, you probably want to hang out with your dad a bunch. And he started taking us after their training ride on a Sunday. We'd go for a little cheeky mountain bike ride. So he got us into it as young kids. My brother and myself would go riding with my dad and some of his friends that were sort of at the forefront of mountain biking in the country. Not my dad. I mean, he definitely didn't break any records, the poor guy. He was a bigger man. He always said the jumping's not the problem, but the landing sure is. And that was kind of his mountain bike career. But he was good. No, he did got like provincial, did pretty decent as a vet. And that's the context, you know. And then us kids being youngsters, we're starting off at, I think my brother was 11 and I was maybe 13. We do our first downhill race in our town at the very mountain that I'm kind of helping with the trails now. We've got a trail center and a bike park. So it's come full circle. So when you're kids and you left your own devices, it's like kids with BMXs. You want to build jumps and you want to do all that stuff. You're not fussed with pedaling up hills and training and all that. And that's where the downhill thing, sort of we forced my dad to go to downhill races with us and all that.
Amazing. Yeah, was racing an obvious thing? Like, because you've got a brother, Jonty. Is he older or younger?
He's 2 years younger. Okay. And he did the first downhill race in the family, I think just before me. He did one maybe when he was 11 and I did the cross country. And then maybe the next phase of races, we sort of did both. So yeah, racing was really all you did because there wasn't bike parks, there weren't trail centers. And thinking back, trail centers and bike parks are incredible. But in our country, they're almost killing racing because that's where you went to ride good trails. You helped build the trails, and that was where the core like skilled mountain bikers hung out, was at a downhill race.
Yeah, definitely. It is changing in that respect. So racing for you was quite a family thing, certainly initially, right? So you've got your brother and you, I guess there's a natural competition. There always is between siblings. But it was your mum and dad that were kind of getting you on the road and taking you to all these events, which in South Africa, they can be quite a long way away from where you live, right?
Yeah, you might have done some research, but they definitely can. You know, some of the races were up where Greg Minnaar lives in Pietermaritzburg, where the World Cup has been. And we live down south. As you know, Cape Town, Somerset West, it's where Greg goes to relax and go on holiday. I just want to put it out there. So if there's a competition between towns, just going to put it out there. But no, Maritzburg is amazing for mountain biking. But it was, I feel like 17 hours in the car. And whoa. Because we're a family and you got to take bikes and spares, it's bikes on the back of a trailer. My dad doing a full day's work. Coming home, checking the bikes on order, but he's probably done that already because he was organized. Packed the trailer, mom's packing the cooler box, and we jump in the car and we drive through the night and we get there sort of midday the next day. No idea. I mean, you just, as kids, you're so naive to what your parents are doing, especially at a young age. And looking back, it's just absurd what they were doing. And we'd get there, walk the track, mom would have the cooler box out, my dad would have the bike stand out, toolbox, and everyone started knowing my dad. Like if there was a problem and other riders maybe weren't so fortunate to have a dad with a toolbox like him, or they didn't have parents at that race, he was kind of the team mechanic. So it was a really family environment as well as with the races, and we'd do track walk and then we'd practice, we'd race. And on Sunday, often he'd drive through the night and get back to work for Monday. So, yeah, it was a complete family affair, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible what parents have given to get you where you got. Were you aware then when it shifted? Because I'm guessing you started out doing this because it's fun, and the racing as well, probably from a fun perspective. But can you put your finger on when it started to shift from being something you did with the family for fun at a weekend to something maybe a little bit more serious where there's perhaps like a future or maybe, you know, a career path or opportunities in the sport?
Yeah, there's definitely a few funny stories. And right in the beginning, people would come up to my dad and mom and say, you need to get more protective gear. These kids are going too fast for their own good. And that's just ignorant young kids, you know. But then I think when I got selected to go to World Champs, and back then juniors were allowed to go 3 years as juniors. Mm-hmm. And it was an Olympic year. So this race was in June in Sierra Nevada, June or July. So I'm going over there as a 15-year-old.
Wow.
I can't tell you how exciting it was. You know, I can still remember a lot of the fun stuff we got up to and Greg Menard's there and he comes over to the team because he's homesick. So he comes, has dinner, and off we go on a Wednesday night as a 15-year-old in Spain. It's not a lot of rules up in the mountain. And off we are. I think we went up to a pub. But getting to where it got serious, you know, then you're meeting all your idols. You're watching them race down the hill. You're racing the very same race and you're looking at these factory rigs. And I think that's probably the spark. I was like, okay, if you do this right, this is an actual career. So I think there was that spark back then as a 15-year-old going to world champs. And then you set your goals to something like that, but you're from South Africa. So mm-hmm. you don't have the means to get to more international races, let alone the funding. So you got to wait each year to go to world champs. So all I'm doing is pushing myself against the elites at home. And luckily excelling and beating a lot of the elites. And that's where you probably think, okay, you know, maybe there's some potential here. If there's some of these elites are going to world champs and getting 50th, 60th, but I'm ahead of them. And then last year as a junior was in Kaprun, Austria. It's an unbelievable course right from the top. I think it's the famous one, one of the famous one where Volio has just pipped Petey. Petey's in the hot seat for so long, and Volios wins that one. And you know, I'm racing against guys like Mark Beaumont, you might know that name,
yeah.
Julian Camellini, a lot of the Aussies, and these guys got over to more races. Some of them were qualifying at World Cups already, and I set myself a goal of top 10, and somehow I reach that. I could be wrong, I feel like I got ninth. Uh-huh. So I don't even know, you know, and that's when you're like, okay, I've got less experience. It's harder for me to get over here. And then you go to Leger World Cup finals.
Because you're in Europe, right?
Yeah, because we're in Europe. So we do a race before Worlds. Luckily, my dad had enough people in the corner to say, look, if you're going to go over, you're going to spend all that money, do a race before. So we did a Swiss Cup. And then we did Worlds. And then we did Leger. And I qualified 78th as a junior. And that's luckily because we were allowed 80 right back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I snapped things into place. I think I was obviously so nervous and got in. And then I finished 50th, first World Cup. I mean, we're talking Sam Hill probably in the top 10. I don't know, we should probably research it. But I'm thinking, you know, 50th for World Cup, that's not bad as a junior, first World Cup. So I think those sort of marks of that there is potential to do this, it started getting serious. But I think where it got serious for my dad, and this is a great story, now I've told on some podcasts, my dad's not around anymore and I'm happy to talk about it because we've got these great memories. He always used to say to me and my brother, and it's come up on a few podcasts, you two boys have more talent in your little pinky than I've got in my entire body. He didn't care if we win or lose, but he was like, don't squander the talent, because he's obviously seen it and people told us. And he could see how we were riding these bikes. And I had an 18th birthday mid-year at home and some friends thought they would be smart. So they took me out to the local mall and there's a pub and they lined up shots on the table midweek, school night. And my parents obviously gave us free rein if we didn't cause too much trouble. I think they went out for dinner. They said, okay, it's your 18th, it's midweek. You can go out with your friends. And they just forced too many shots down. And I'll never forget this. I came home and I didn't keep the shots down. And parents came home and I was puking everywhere. And obviously it was hell to pay for this. And it wasn't because I went drinking. It was because we had a national the very next weekend. And my dad woke me up the next morning and says, you're off to school. I was like, I can't get out of bed. I don't care, you're going to school. I couldn't eat or drink anything till the second break, whatever you have at school. I was a mess. And I'm not proud of it, but it was a big lesson. And obviously, I think he could see the potential and the talent in his boys. And and as we said, imagine the effort they're putting in.
Yeah.
Now I'm pissing up as a now newly 18-year-old midweek, and we got a national coming up. I got to that national. I don't know if subtly I wanted to prove him wrong or I just excelled at the track, but like I won by a winning margin at the time. So I'm super proud of that. And it's just like a good memory and a lesson that he was trying to instill in us Is don't piss it away. He didn't care if we won. He just cared, like, we put effort in. We appreciated the bikes and the effort the parents were putting in.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I think I've heard you say in the past, like, a lot of your work ethic comes from your parents. Like, they were happy to help, but they needed to see that you were and your brother were willing to put in the graft and put in the work and use the talent that you have, I guess.
Yeah, I think you, looking back now, you must subconsciously as a teenager understand how much effort they're putting in. You know, my dad, as you can hear, is quite an inspiration to me because he's just a pharmacist, right? But that takes a lot of work to do a trade like that. There's a lot of schooling. But he also was doing these races for us. And then he got his commissaire's license or whatever you call it, accreditation.
Yeah.
And he's been to Olympics. He's been to Commonwealth Games. And he's done a million of these nationals in South Africa on top of a full-time job. So he would take unpaid leave to go then work. Just think about that. But it wasn't for the money. It was for the experience. And then he also went to Seattle a bunch of years. And I don't know if the pros are going to Seattle at the moment, this year and in the past, as much as they used to.
It used to be a big deal, right?
Yeah. And my dad would take unpaid leave. Yeah, he'd go earn some dollars. But, like, honestly, he was doing it before I was there. And then when I went over, I think as an excuse to be at a race. So he'd graft for 2 weeks, you know, at this race, helping with the downhill course and bunting and God knows what else. Yeah, so it's cool actually going down memory lane, Chris, because, yeah, I think you subconsciously can see the work ethic that your parents have. And it doesn't come out of nothing, you know. So I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. So, yeah, how did you eventually end up in the US then? Because obviously, like you've alluded to, being from South Africa, it's a long way to get to where most of the racing's happening. The track kind of, you know, gradient challenge is probably higher in most of the World Cup venues than it would be in South Africa. Maybe Pietermaritzburg is the exception, but, like, it's key, and I think Greg showed that as well, like, it's key to get out of South Africa. So how do you make that happen as a young and upcoming rider? You've had this show of potential, I guess, in your last World Champs as a junior and your first World Cup, but how do you convert that into actually getting to the US?
Well, I mean, I think there were a rider or two before Greg on the downhill side that raced overseas, and Greg going so early, not finishing school and campaigning in England, you could see you needed that experience. So that was the next goal. And lucky enough, I met Sven and Anka quite early, and they had a bit of connections in the States. So that was the next question mark. Okay, so you don't get a ride for getting 50th at a World Cup, even though you're a junior. And doing heel clickers at the duel in Leger doesn't get you a ride either. But that was the next question mark. How do we get there? And I had these contacts in the States, and it sounded like they would maybe help house me in between races, and we're going to have to self-fund this thing. So, and then luck came my way because the global racing team sort of was downscaling because of funding that Martin Whiteley had a 3-year deal, whatever it was. And then the last year they pulled the funding, but he didn't want to lose the team. He thought if he ran the team for another year, then something else would come, and good move by him because he's on the circuit. I think Honda came. So I think my dad had a call into Greg. Now, you can imagine how excited I am that my dad's going to call Greg Minnaar. You know, like, yeah, I've met him at a national too, but we're not phoning each other like we do now, talking a bunch of bollocks. And I think I rode my road bike to his work because I wanted to be there while he speaks to him, you know. And then it was either that or one of the photographers, Gary Perkins, that said, let me connect you with Martin or something. So I don't know how it all happened, but we got an email into Martin or a call with him. So thanks. I don't remember it fully. I don't know if it was Perkins, good word, maybe Greg as well. And Martin gave us a call and an email about he doesn't have funding to provide a full team, but what he can do is he can get bikes, he can get support. You'll be on the team and you kind of take care of your own stuff, and then he can help when he brings Maddie and at the time maybe Cesar Rojo, who's designed Mondraker and now that other brand. So that was that. And when he came to Canada, I could stay with him. We'd be on the team. And then world champs and a European round at the end of the year. So, man, dude, that was a lottery ticket. If I tell you, yeah, going to the Norbers, which were big back then in America, with the help of Sven and Anka and beg, borrowing, stealing, making friends, hitching rides. But luckily, you go to Michelin, sponsored by Michelin. Hi, I'm Andrew Nietling. Sorry, who? No, I'm on Global. They're like, oh, yeah, bring your bike in. Yeah, we'll sort it out. So then you start making relations. Same as SRAM. First time I meet the guys at SRAM, it's because luckily I was on Global, so we were sponsored by them. And then, you know, I learned quickly to go thank them with beers. And they probably felt sorry for this lonely South African. The late Mungtog. Dude, the list goes on people that have helped me. So that was the lottery ticket, is getting on support from Global Racing, Martin Whiteley, in that first year. But I was on my own. Working my own bike, got a bit of support, that changed my tires. That was it. Suspension maybe got service, but yeah, that was me over in America doing all the Norbers, which were big back then. You know, even back then, 2003, PD would come to some, Cedric, all the Aussies, Rennie, Kovarik, Sam Hill. I mean, if you could get on a podium at a World Cup, Norber,
yeah,
easily was as good as a World Cup.
Yeah, it was huge back then, eh? Like, how did you make it work then? Because there must have been sacrifices to make, because you're living on a super tight budget and everything costs money, right? Like, going to a gym costs money, eating well costs money. Like, how do you make all of that, like, work as a full private, well, not a privateer, I guess, but very limited support, no income from the racing?
Yeah, I think luckily gym wasn't as important back then, or at least the knowledge of it wasn't as important. So we just dirt jumped, rode XC on our dirt jump bikes and downhill. And but how did I make it work? I mean, I think I went over with $500, and, you know, luckily my dad in the background helped with some race entries. Finn and Uncle were amazing, but I mean, I was eating 2-minute noodles and mac and cheese out of a box, and luxury was putting a can of tuna with the thing and McDonald's burgers because they were cheap. So that's $1 for a burger. Then you go ask for a water cup and you get Sprite, because, you know, it looks like sparkling water. So it was great, dude. I mean, you just make it work, don't you? But you ever grounded tiles in your life?
No.
I don't suggest anyone gets into it. It's hard, tough work. It's not good on the knees, especially for a guy that's trying to pedal. So they were odd jobs, you know. Sven and Anka were really hard workers as well. Anka had jobs in between their racing. Sven had, you know, his photography and riding and working at bike shops. So I did some, they hooked me up with some friends that were contractors. So I did grouting tiles. So we just made it work, man. Beg, borrow, and steal, living on couches, and off you went. It was some of the best times, but I luckily got hooked up. So speaking of that, so there was a race in Fontana, and Gwyn's quite famous for speaking about this race. Mm-hmm. Really awesome guys that put on this race series out in Fontana in California. Horrible pedaling section, not a big mountain, but some of the greats have raced there. And we went to practice because you could walk, you kind of shuttled a bit and then you walk to the top, pretty inexpensive day. The race is the next day. I didn't have money for the race, so I didn't go to the race. But the Aussies had seen me the day before, so they asked Sven, where's this kid? Like, he seemed good. Like, where is he? No, he's, you know, he decided not to race. I couldn't afford the entry fee, and it wasn't a priority. And then luckily Sven, being Sven, kind of said, well, what are you guys up to? No, we're going to Big Bear because the team's got a condo up there. And they invited me along, and the rest is history. So I got that's taken cool, under the wing by Nathan Rennie, Jared Grace, Bryn Atkinson, and Sam Hill, whether that's a good or a bad thing.
A bit of both, I guess.
We went up to Big Bear for a month, and I learned to train or ride my bike. I learned to ride downhill with those guys.
And learned to party.
Certainly did. There was work hard, play hard. But, you know, Rennie got a bad rep, but did he lived on his bike? I mean, if we weren't dirt jumping, then we were downhilling. If we weren't downhilling, we probably went for a spin on our jump bikes with a seat up. He was a strong individual. But, yeah, we did. I mean, that day and age, and when you're young, you definitely definitely learned to play hard and work hard, you know.
Fair play. And you topped up the bank account with some spot prizes as well, right? They used to occasionally have like best jump or whatever at a race, and you'd almost focus on that rather than the race result.
Yep. You've dug into definitely one of my fondest stories. Durango, I think it's Norba Finals. So I'd had a little bit of success, which you mustn't forget to tell the story. Sorry for some of the listeners that heard it. But Durango, what Chris was talking about, I'm going to Europe. I don't even know if I have money. Obviously, I got my dad and mom support, or they're remortgaging their house at the stage to pay in the USDs. And someone comes up with best trick or something on a jump, and they're going to have it during qualifying. So you can imagine no pro is thinking this is a good idea. It's qualifying of a Norba, you know. So Sam Hill, all those boys, I'm thinking, well, this is a great idea. I'm hill clicking this thing. And it was a $500 prize or something. So here I come in qualifying. Heel clicker, some crap jump going into the woods. Over jump this jump. So I get the heel clicker, I land, but I'm carrying way too much space into the woods. So I wad it going into the woods in my qualifying run. But I won the cash. So
there you go.
I think there was that, and maybe some of the. I think I went to Europe with $1,000 in my pocket and not a good qualifying result. But you know. I'd already,
it's gotta be done.
Yeah. But another funny one. So this is when skin suits were still a thing. So Martin Whiteley insisted we ride skin suits. I think a few guys were still doing it. So I don't know if I really pushed back at all. And I do think skin suits for that time when they were at Worlds were pretty cool. Once here at Worlds was cool. So I'm in this skin suit and I've qualified. So granted, this is the first year in the States. Uh-huh. Qualified fourth at Vermont. This is a gnarly track, horribly gnarly. It's wet, a lot of slab rocks out in the open, ski runs. It's unbelievable. Now at the top of the track, and it's eerie at the top, so quiet. First time I qualified this well. And sponsors, John Cancellier from SRAM, he ran Black Box for a while. And I don't know if Dawson was also there. So these are big SRAM guys that I'm trying to impress. And top third of this track, I'm hurtling down this track. I didn't feel too nervous, but I don't know if they sort of shouted and I just sort of lost concentration. And I just clipped something and went flying over the bars in front of these guys in a skin suit at Vermont. So carcass down, and then I get up. Now I've crashed in front of these guys and I've ruined my race run. You know, like I could have just probably cruised down and got a top 10. That would have been an incredible result first year over. So I've managed to wad in front of these sponsors, and then I managed to get a flat tire even further down. So, yeah, you bring back some good memories.
Good stuff, man. And you mentioned earlier Eric Carter, but he was quite a bit of a mentor to you, right? And was he instrumental in helping you get, like, a first salary deal?
Definitely. Eric Carter, I owe a lot to him, and I just think he's one of the better guys that have come through the industry, really has. And he was on Mongoose at the time, and this was my third year over. And look, the challenge is, as a South African, the industry's in America, so they're going to back Americans first. So I don't think it's wrong or right. It's pretty natural. And that year, I'd got two top 10s in a World Cup, one in Brazil, one in Angel Fire, and something else. I don't know if that's when I won the Norba. I'd already had to do that. It wasn't okay, we saw him qualify fourth, we've seen him get a top 10 at a Norba the year before, you know, let's see what this potential's like. I had to go out and win a Norba. I had to go out and get the top 10s. I didn't think much of it. I wasn't bitter or resentful. And I remember EC calling me into the truck and saying, look, you know, Mongoose is looking to add to their downhill program. And what do you think? I mean, it was amazing. It was really cool. The only ship part was at EC the next year. We go to Vigo in Spain. And EC was going to do maybe four cross only and a bit of downhill. Shame. And he hurt his back first race. And from then, he was pretty riddled with injuries. So he wasn't on the race circuit as much as I would have loved. But he was a really good mentor. I love his attitude towards racing. Always having a good time, but incredibly hard worker.
Yeah, must have felt good then to finally step it up to have an income and not have to be and I'm guessing it wasn't a huge income at that point, but like not to have to be going for the heel clicker to get the $500 to go to Europe kind of thing.
No, it was amazing. You know, it really was. Look, those years were awesome. They were fun. I wouldn't take them back. They sort of taught me to appreciate things and everything else. But to get that factory ride, and I'll tell you, as a youngster, you just scroll straight down to the salary. I didn't look at the T's and C's. I just opened the email. And I knew Bryn back then, and I think he was on GT already, so I kind of had a guesstimate of what you could make. And I just scrolled straight down. But the more important part was the mechanic, the support, housing, that whole structure. I mean, that's what you dream for. And that's what you need, you know, to consistently perform at that level.
Yeah, definitely. And at that point, I think, like, not only was the sport progressing, but the understanding and the appreciation and the adoption of training was kind of becoming more of a thing in the sport as well. I think we'd seen maybe Nico, G, athletes like that, taking that side a bit more seriously. And this is where, again, your work ethic kind of crept into things and you took a pretty serious approach to that. Can you talk to us a bit about how you got into training and like how you went away and got the support that you needed? Because I think that's quite interesting. You've worked with a few of the sports greats from that side of thing over the years.
Yeah, myself, yeah, as you've said, maybe subconsciously building work ethic back in the day, but understanding and watching, you know, these family friends, Erica, go to the Olympics and then her transition into coaching. So through my dad or her sort of offering it, I had help training as a youngster. Obviously bike time, anyone listening that's young, I think bike time and skill development is the most critical in the beginning, but because there will become time to train and it will get become a career and a job. But luckily I had that, and I just use it to build confidence. I like to know I'm doing everything I can. I tick that box and then we can go to the races. So quite early on, I was always asking, you know, who's training who, what's going on. And I think early on, Scott Sharples, the great Aussie downhiller, was training some of these Aussies. Now, I couldn't afford that. But luckily for me, someone like Scott Sharples was willing to engage with me, and I asked him, and he was willing to help me out for some parts and a fork or whatever. You know, like we bartered that. So, yeah, I remember instilling sort of that quite early on. So someone like Scott Sharples, and then things got a lot more serious, and I heard of Stefan Gerard, who I think Greg still works with on the physical cardio side, and then he's added Alan Milway. So I was like, well, if he's coaching the best downhiller of all time in Nico at the time, and then yeah. Greg, like, what does that cost, and can I do it? Like, why not try that? So yeah, I've kind of forgotten about that, but I've always wanted to have a coach, and some people do it without, someone like Graves, someone like Lopes, but I used to doubt if I'm doing the right thing. Like, I don't want to overtrain. I don't want to undertrain. Like, how do you know? And it wasn't a passion of mine to learn the intricacies of how the body exactly works at that stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you so, I employed – sorry?
I was going to say you were quite structured about it, right? Like, if it was on the plan, it got done.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time when there were sprints on the plan. I don't know, if chain fell off or it snapped at the jumps. I'm on my own, smashed my chin into the ground. And luckily we had phones at that stage, so I took a photo of my chin. I was like, well, if I need stitches, I probably got to go get that done. But if I don't need stitches, I'm going to finish the training program. So, yeah, I don't know where that comes from. I guess I'm just sort of kind of a fixer and a problem solver and quite organized. Like my stuff somewhat in a fashion. Like if my inbox has 33 emails, it drives me a little mad, you know. I'll leave the tax one, you know, that one can be unread. But there's shit to get done. I like to like get it done so then I can get on with my day. And that was the training. I like to get up early, knock it out, know that I've worked my ass off. Because then like lying on the couch, recovering, lack of a better term, feels way better.
Yeah, and that's a big part of being a good athlete, right? I think a lot of people underestimate the power of good recovery. Like you need, I think it was Chris Kilmurray that said to me, to be able to turn on, you've got to be able to turn off, which is quite a good way to look at things, I think, and often missed by people.
Definitely. I like his work. And I think he's got also quite a big holistic approach to things, which that would be, you know, what that is, energy of athletes. And so I really like his work as well. He's a fascinating guy to chat to. And I couldn't agree more. You know, sometimes less is more. Sometimes you need a break from training. Sometimes you need a break from your downhill bike. Sometimes, you know, every athlete's different. But yeah, understanding that recovery is equally important. And you spoke to it. Back in the day, there was sort of, it was more hidden. You know, I had to like dig, like, who's training Greg? Like, now you just know, right? There's enough podcasts, you've heard it. Oh, cool, he's added Alan Millway. Like, but back then, it was this hidden thing of the sport. Like Sean Palmer, right? This whole partying, drinking, craziness thing. It's bullshit because it was show. He didn't do it the night before the race, really. Maybe here and there. But that was a dedicated, fit individual that had a party showmanship. And that was back in the day. Now people are building confidence, I think, from showing that they're working the hardest, showing themselves in the gym. You know, whether they're keeping sponsors happy or just trying to get in another athlete's head. Like, I think, you know, there's kind of smoke and mirrors to the training aspect now.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it used to be people almost seemed embarrassed to admit they trained, right? Like, you wouldn't have thought you'd see it. But then I remember as a kid seeing Petey and Warner ride past on road bikes. And I was just like, huh? Really? Like, those guys go on road bikes and train? Like, it was just so hidden back then, eh?
Yeah, what do you think of that? You're totally right. It was when downhill mountain bike was trying to find itself and get away from Lycra and wear the moto kit, you know, and it wasn't cool to be on the road bikes. It wasn't cool that you were downhill, you're a rock star. You party and you hurtle down the hill and you party some more. I guess they were trying to build a brand out of the sport. So it has progressed a lot to be taken seriously. Like, these are some of the most fit individuals to do what they do. Even though you're only racing down a hill for 2 to 5 minutes, people on the street don't understand how fit you need to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, it was shown that it worked, right? We saw athletes that looked different. Like, G was a machine. Oh, well, still is a machine. But, like, I think once people saw that worked, there was a more of a willingness to be like, okay, maybe we need to do that as well. And as everyone's doing it, it becomes less kind of geeky, I guess, and more accepted, maybe.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. There was an awesome phase where skill and grit and bike time was able to compete with maybe the structured guys. Now you've got skill, you've got grit, you've got living on a bike since you were 2 years old like Jackson. He's only going to get stronger. He's only going to get forced to train more, you know. And he's going up against Greg, who's super experienced and has been one of the fittest guys undercover for so long. And against Loic, Amri, that guy's a beast. That guy's strong. The Prilla, those guys are machines.
Yeah, it's insane. All the boxes.
Well, I guess Gwyn sort of showed like what brute force on a course could do. Mm-hmm. Like being able to hang on a really tough course versus a skill like Sam Hill. He was fit, but he just had the skill to get down fast. And then Gwyn kind of said, well, I'm going to straight line everything, even if it's not the smoothest line. If I can hang on, you know, I'm going to make track speed.
Yeah, no, it's been super interesting to see how that changed. And over the time, you've ridden for like a good number of teams. So you've spent some time with Global, Mongoose, Honda Turner, Trek World Racing, Giant, and then latterly Polygon United Ride. Like, from all those teams, where would you say you felt your best? And like, what do you put that down to? Because that's a massive variety of different teams and structures and setups and support, right?
Yeah, most certainly. You know, and the first 3 years were, you know, more shop privateer style teams, even though I was on Global doing my own thing. But maybe when you get into the factory ride, I would say support and professionalism was Trek. You know, getting on Trek was a good time for me. You know, I'd come off a bike that was, honestly, I can say it now, just subpar of shit. It had a design flaw and nothing personal against the guys that designed it. Like, it worked on some tracks, but it just couldn't work. It was a URT style rear triangle. I mean, just didn't work. So to get on Trek and what they were doing with that bike at the time, I mean, they took us to a wind tunnel. Just think about that. Think about the money they put in. So that was really good at a good time. But with that comes pressure. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've told Martin, but riding for Martin, depending on the rider, brings even more pressure because of how successful he is and running a great program. And even him being at the race is like, he's not intentionally doing it. And it's just like the way maybe I took it on incorrectly, you know, I was like, shit, I want to perform for this team. I think it was more like Trek Factory actually. But I'm just saying, like, when you have someone that's successful putting the team together, then you've got Trek. You see what they're putting into the bikes. So that was really good from a professional side. But I said, like, I think feeling the most comfortable is when I got on Giant.
Okay.
You know, like, with the structure and the people I knew there, like, that was a touch more relaxed atmosphere. And I think it showed through, like, you know, I got my first podium with Trek, took a little longer than some would expect on paper. Lots of good qualities, lots of potential, showing speed. Got in my own way a little bit. Had a bad bike for some years. And then Giant, you know, I had 4 good years with Giant and we had some good times. I had good times with all of them. Like, they're all pros and cons to all the teams, really.
For sure, yeah. And when you're racing well then, what would you say are the key, like, elements to that recipe for you? And has that changed over your career?
Yeah, I mean, if I was to give myself advice if I went back, it wouldn't be train harder or be more dedicated. Like, I think I ticked that box pretty well. I think I would try, I don't know how though, because racing is a pressure-filled environment, but like to try take myself less seriously, try trust the process more, you know, which will then potentially help with the outcomes. But for me, myself, like, my personality is quite extroverted. So for me, having a good time and being a happy rider is a fast rider. Greg has his way of approaching things. I have mine. Loic has his. And maybe learning what made me tick earlier would have been really good. But, I mean, I kind of did that mostly. And some teams, they didn't understand it. You know, they don't understand that after quali, I might go shit talk with Brendan or ride around the pits. Like, I needed to relieve that stress. I needed to be out there. I didn't need to be in my bubble overthinking things. But that sometimes looks like a rider is not serious.
Yeah.
And it does not. It certainly looks like he's not being serious if he's not watching his GoPro and he's not. But, you know, each rider is so different. So, yeah, fascinating question to look back at.
Do you think teams are getting better at, like, understanding what their athletes need, like that appreciation of the fact that everyone's different, the recipe's not the same? Do you think that's becoming more understood?
Well, I think that yes and no, because watching the race tapes, have you watched the series yet?
Or I haven't seen all of it. I've seen a couple of them.
Yeah. So I don't want to look, it's a show again, so they've made the project about the Trek XE team. Mm-hmm. And Matt guy, like, I got all respect from. I'm not down talking this, but I'm looking at it going, okay, they want to do this team lap, which I know by the end of it works. But you've got all these individuals doing an individual sport. It isn't actually road racing.
Yeah.
Now, I like his method of it, but it is a catch 22 to put everyone into a box as a team. You know, And it's tough. So I think teams are doing a lot better job of it. And it is a team because you've got to travel them for 6 months. And you want to try have a culture where what he's trying to do is, you know, if you're rooting for your teammate and he does better, it can bring you up. And if you do better, he's going to do better and the team will do better. I do agree with the overall message. And as you said, the challenge is we've got all these individuals, all these different personality types. So because one guy needs to warm up for 15 minutes and he needs to do it exactly like this, but then the other guy, but if he's not doing that, then he's not going to perform. You know, it's not one size fits all from a team manager point down is what I'm trying to say. It's a really, but then also you don't want 6 prima donnas on the team.
ideally not.
And for me to sit here and not say that I had prima donna tendencies or I wanted a special tire or I threw my toys out the cot because they didn't have three backup tires of my choice. I'm thinking, you know what would have been better is to give less shits. That would have done me better, because if I was a privateer and I tread on the tire, good. Let's go smash it, because I had to prove something, right?
Yeah, feels like some of the most successful racers have managed to bring that to the top level, right? Like Ratboy, I guess, is a good example of a sort of run what you brung, I'll just get on it and ride it. And all that stress therefore is gone, right? You just focus on getting down the hill fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's that whole ignorance of bliss versus someone that's so experienced and knowledgeable. And yeah, and it comes out with Greg, right? He really knows what he needs. He knows what he's had in the past to perform. So how do you not want to rely on that package? If you know when you're on this bike and it felt like this, this is when I did well. So the experience can also be a disservice to someone like that. And I think you brought up a good point. Ratboy, that's personality. Yeah. Dude, he didn't shower at some of the races for days. I was like, Ratboy, I don't understand. Like when I take a shower, I feel 40% more energy in my body. But, you know, he's just YOLO. I mean, I would love to be like that. And that's why I loved hanging out with Brendan and Rennie. Some of the most lessons in my career I probably learned from Rennie on what to give a shit about. Yeah.
Yeah, give us some of that. I was going to ask, like, from teammates who you've learned the most from, but from riders in general that you've had the ability to hang out with and ride with and work with, like, obviously Rennie's a standout for you. What sort of stuff do you take away from Nathan?
Yeah, from Rennie, just looking back, I got a lot of respect for Rennie. And he had this amazing ability to really not take himself too seriously, to self-deprecate himself, and also what really matters. But he was really hardworking and also analytical. And he's the one that he's famous for saying, like, your practice, all you're doing is getting your exact plan for the race run, and that what gear you start in, where you break in. You know, you think he was just riding down the track as fast as humanly possible, but, you know, he teaches you that you're just getting in information so that you can be as planned as you can for the race. But I really liked his carefree attitude, because I overthink things, same as Brendan. Brendan, he'd be like, why are you... I think he was teammates with Troy, and I was similar. I was like, if I make the decision the night before, then it's less decisions to make on the day. So pack out my kit and, oh, it's going to rain here. Get my race goggles ready and my roll-off goggles. I mean, that was not like Brendan. And I think you can take certain traits from other people if they're getting in your way, you know?
Yeah, good to have examples from people on the opposite end of the spectrum from you, I guess, because it's good to find that balance, right? We all sit somewhere on a spectrum on all these different things, and it's nice to be able to move along that sometimes. I'm the same as you. I'm an overthinker, right? Like, and that can be the death of me sometimes. So seeing people that are like, be fine, just ride. Like, it's refreshing.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It is refreshing. And you've got to be true to yourself. But so you like that as well. You have a plan and you like to be organized. And I saw when we were planning the podcast, you've got your, you know, like we've committed on WhatsApp, but you're like, okay, I'm going to send you the invite because that's how you structure probably through your email box. And I'm like, oh, that's great. Cool. And as soon as I change the time, you change that. And that's how you probably get out of your own head. Yeah, it makes sense.
Definitely, man. So as well as riding with Rennie and many other people throughout your career, you also had a chance to go riding with Travis Pastrana. I'm keen to hear a bit about that, but I think you've forgotten some of it.
I was going to say, do you want the part that I remember or the part that I forgot?
Let's have both.
So we're on Giant and we're in Whistler. I was quite lucky. All the teams I was on went to Whistler. So that place is, as many listeners will either know or want to know, it is incredible. It's cool. And then I was doing the Crankworx commentary. I got to go back all the time as well. So that was cool. So Travis Chipres, who was a really big help to me in the industry, he did my contract at Mongoose, actually, funny enough. And back then, he had connections with Pastrana. He'd always flowed in bikes and helped him, I think, even then. Then he moved over to Giant. And Travis was coming up and he says, hey guys, so we'd heard rumors that Pastrana was maybe going to come to Crankworx. Didn't think much of it. Then we get there and Travis says, hey, you riders, dinner's booked for 8 o'clock tonight. Don't be late. Someone might join us. I'm thinking, no ways. No ways. And lo and behold, we sit down to dinner. I don't know if Bailey was one of the mechanics on site. I don't know if Colin Bailey was there with us. I forget who. And then I think Danny and Marcelo, maybe whoever's at that time on the team. We sit down with Trevor Pastrana and his wife and Chipriz. And super casual dinner, having beers, talking very openly. Yeah, it was really special, you know. And then at that dinner, it's sort of, okay, you guys going riding tomorrow? Oh, sure. And I'd heard he's been there before and he rode with Ben Reed once. And I'd heard him say they'd stop. And then Ben was like, oh, how was that section over the roots? And Pastrana said, you guys are crazy. Reed's like, what are you talking about? I said, you guys jumped all those roots. How do you? And you're thinking, wow, this guy's just one of us, like a mountain bike, you know? And off we go. So it's, we plan to meet at the lift and he gets a bike from Giant. I forget. It was just myself, another rider and Pastrana and maybe someone else. I don't really know. We had a whole morning of riding. Cool. He's, as you know, I mean, he's like he is on all the videos, super down to earth. We had a great time. And, we break for lunch and he's like, I'm gonna go for lunch, see where my wife is, and that was awesome, thanks so much, you guys are crazy. We're like, that is the most ridiculous thing to come out of your mouth. Like, you're literally the godfather of, you know, extreme sports. Okay, no problem, I've got A-line practice. And off I go, and I think why I was so cocky was probably a good morning with Pastrana and I'd won the race the year before. So I was super confident, had a good bike set up, and, you know, that was going to be a goal, is to sort of repeat. And I got bucked on one of these fast jumps on A-line. To give you an idea that, you know, the jumps are built amazingly well, but when you're at race speed, they're going to be more kicky, and I just got one wrong. Huge crash. Luckily, I wasn't injured any worse, but I definitely got a concussion and knocked my head pretty well. I had to go get scans at the hospital. And I was pretty out of it. You know, don't think I went to dinner that night. I had to recover. And then the next morning, Danny's, how are you doing? And dude, I can't believe you rode with Pastrana. I was like, I did what? I rode with who? Like, dude, you rode with Pastrana. And I just didn't have any short-term memory at that time. So it's funny now. It's quite dangerous. I was like, you're kidding me. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, so where were we last week? No, you're in Mount St. Anne. I was like, oh, cool. How did I do? Yeah, I don't know. You were maybe in the top 10, but you qualified third or second. I don't know what I qualified. I was like, I wouldn't even believe him because I hadn't qualified that well ever. I think like the previous best was fourth. And he's like, no, you qualified second in the rain or third. I don't know. I wouldn't believe him. Yeah, it was so it's funny now. And but it was cool. So we go to dinner the second night. Pastrana's there and that whole Nitro Circus crew. And he comes over. He's like, hey, I heard you had a crash. Are you all right? And I'm like, yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, no, I'm all right. And I still didn't remember much of this ride. I'm thinking, what a waste. You get to ride with a guy like this and you go and crash afterwards. It's mostly come back now. And then we go to the bar. And obviously, I'm not going to drink because I'm like, that's obviously a dangerous idea. But I'm not going to miss opportunity when he says, hey, we're going to go shoot some pool at the Longhorn. The crew's going out. So off we go and we're shooting a bit of pool. And he comes over and he's trying to be funny. And he goes, yeah, so you don't remember much? And I was like, yeah, not a lot. He goes, yeah, and you were trying to pick up my wife as well at dinner. And I was like, luckily, I switched on. And I said, do you blame me? Now he's taken aback. He's like, what? I said, well, you married her. She's successful and she's pretty. I mean, do you blame me? So then he was stumped, you know. So I had enough wit to go back at him. But a fond memory now that I kind of do remember it a bit.
Yeah, amazing experience. And throughout your career, I guess, like there's been one very constant presence, and that's Greg Minnaar, who's had like insane success over the years. And I guess he's kind of earned that crown of being like the South African rider that all the fans know. And I guess this kind of sounds bad, but it sort of left you as like the other South African rider for a good chunk of your career, even though there was like podiums, lots of promise, lots of success. Like, did you personally feel that? And like, was that hard to deal with?
What, being the bridesmaid my whole career?
Being the bridesmaid to Greg, yeah.
I mean, not really, because at the end of the day, luckily he was that good. He's the GOAT, you know? So I think I was able to just reflect, like, okay, you're getting smoked by the guy that's the best in the world. So even the second in the world is playing bridesmaid to the guy a lot of the time. And it's all earned. You know, I got utmost respect to Greg. I would think in the beginning it was a little bit of competition, me coming up. Like, you know, we didn't share lines in the beginning. We didn't do any of that sort of stuff. I was probably the little kid coming up. But I think later in the career it was really cool, and especially now that I'm done, I've got a good relationship with him. And yeah, I mean, it was always going to be tough. You know, you're doing as good as you can, but you're not getting the awards in South Africa because there's always someone better than you. You're always going to be the second best downhiller when he's riding. But as I said, he's still going. So everyone's played a little bit of bridesmaid to him at some stage, unless you won the overall that year. But if he's winning world champs and he's winning world cups, yeah, definitely maybe could have got more accolades at home or some sponsors here. I mean, what does it matter now? So no, I don't think there was too much resentment, because what can you do?
Yeah, that's an amazing way to look at it. It's hard sometimes to step back and take that perspective. But like, yeah, when you're losing to someone who's beating everyone week in, week out, that's not such a bad thing, is it?
Yeah, and then if you do go and beat him, then, you know, there's that mutual respect that builds and it's fair and square. Then you can be pretty proud of yourself, which, look, to be honest, it didn't happen that much at a World Cup level, but it didn't happen that much for a lot of riders. So, yeah, I was able to get one over him at some big races, and that's something I can be proud of, you know?
100%, man. And we've got a new South African coming in. I might get the name pronunciation wrong, but I'm sure you can correct me. Theo Erlangsen. Has it been fun seeing him getting involved and seeing the banter between him and Greg as well? There's been a bit of friendly rivalry there.
Yeah, Theo. I mean, Greg and I have had to bail him out of some shit. But yeah, I mean, to me, Theo, I wish he'd focus on one thing. Like, I think he's got an ungodly amount of talent. He's a fast rider. Obviously, he's enjoying Darkfest. And, you know, I think it's just with what social media is doing now and building your brand, that's his choice what to focus on. And it's to his personality. So I can't fault it. But if I was to get my way with him and he would actually listen, like I thought he could have quite a career in downhill on a team, you know. But then again, you know, if he's having a good time and he's successful at Darkfest and doing it his way, like, I can't fault that. But he is a big talent. I don't want his head to get any bigger than it is. But he is he's a really good bike rider, really good bike handler. He really is. And he's fast. Like, you know, like the speed and rawness he has on a downhill bike is impressive.
Yeah, for sure. And these younger riders coming through, like, I think we've got this first generation that have spent their entire lifetime on incredible bikes and kit that older riders like us didn't have. We started on pretty shonky stuff, so they've been riding incredibly fast from a very young age. Do you think it's changing the sport? Like, I think we saw glimmers of it last year with Jackson and Jordan entering the elite ranks and taking victories straight away and just, in certain cases, looking on another level and riding in such a, you know, fun to watch and like an incredible style down the track. Like, do you think it's going to be harder and harder for the older riders to challenge that younger upcoming group?
I mean, it certainly is sort of narrowing the gap from someone at a junior level. And I think you might have thought the same as me. We've seen the times, right? They could do the same times, if not faster. Okay, they did it 3 hours earlier as a junior. So you think the speed's there, the potential's there. What impresses me is doing that in the elite level so quickly. Now, I know Jordan winning the first one, he didn't expect to, so there wasn't a lot of pressure. And you could see what the expectation, the pressure, okay, it made it a little harder. Mm-hmm. But Jackson, it's just so impressive that they're able to do it straight off the bat with what I would think is some pressure. But maybe they're not feeling it because they know they've got more years to come. That certainly seems what Jackson's doing. But as far as a talent speed level, man, it's impressive. It really is impressive. And that's where the top guys have to up their game. And that's where experience comes through. And someone like Loic, there's a long season. And he's able to be patient and strike when he's riding at his best. And maybe not strike when he knows the track doesn't suit him or he's not feeling his best. So, yeah, I think it is going to be harder and harder. And there's more of these juniors. Now, the next level of juniors, if they have the talent, are they not going to believe that they can also do it if they've seen Jackson doing it? We're seeing it in other sports.
Yeah, for sure.
If you see someone before you winning, does it create more pressure or does it make you believe in yourself more that you potentially could be capable of doing that?
Yeah, no, it's going to be exciting for sure. And with all these new riders entering the sport, there's this older generation that have to make that decision some point. Like, when do they step back? You took that call in 2017, I think. You kind of moved away from World Cup racing. Was that a hard decision to make for you?
Yeah, I think for any athlete, it really is super challenging to make the call when to do it. Sometimes it's nicer when it sort of gets forced on you, I think. But there's a certain tough process moving forward. So myself, maybe I overthink things and I kind of always knew it was going to come to an end, but you never really plan for that exact day to happen. And then going into after 2016, might be the last year that I was on the circuit, I didn't really know doing the last race that it would be my last year. And I'd had an injury the year before and I felt that I was riding at my highest level, you know, just not having much luck and some issues with the bikes. And then I get injured. And then I'd never really come back from an injury that took me out of more than a race or sitting out for one race in a season. So touch wood, I'd been pretty lucky. And it took me a while to get back up to speed. And that's tough for your confidence. And I think when you're older, it's going to take you longer for your body as well as for your mind. So I didn't really know at the time, but then going into off season, I'd made the call. I'd been away from home too much, living out of bags. I kind of wanted to find a team that I was happy with. Bike was good. Didn't really care about the paycheck. Good teammates, bike. And I was thinking Scott could be that team because Brendan was on that. And I thought, what better way to do it, you know? And I wanted to fly home even on my own dime in between races more.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, guys from UK, Europe, I think they've got an advantage as the season drags on. I really do. And you can see it in the results. Some of these guys that are away from home for too long, it gets a bit of a problem 3/4 of the way the season. So for me, I go in the off season and it was crickets. There was a few options here or there. And I've spoken about before, I even chatted to my dad because he was around at that time. He passed only just after that. And he said, well, why don't you just self-fund it? Like, you've been smart with your money and you've invested and you didn't piss it all away. I said, well, you know, I think there's a problem here because it's not just the money. Like, gut-wise, I'm not quite sure. And also, I don't think the return on investment's a smart idea. I'm going to do a year. I don't know if they're going to pick me up on a factory ride again even after that. So, yeah, I started chatting to a few teams, and then there was this opportunity for this ambassador thing with Scott, and it was kind of the universe sort of giving me the decision.
Okay.
In my gut, I wasn't sure I wanted to hurtle down the hill anymore, and the pressure was getting to me. And I'm like, okay, well, whether I retire at 32, I retire at 35, I was never going to get to 40 like Greg or 42 or however old he is. Because it's easier, you know, once you've won a bunch of races, like when you're not so good, you're still on the podium. When you're not so good after that, you're in the top 10. I was like, really good race. I could get on the podium. Mm-hmm. Average, I'd be in the top 10. But if I start not being average, you know, I'm 15th, I'm 20th. Like, no one wants to pay you. And whatever, this younger kid should get the wage anyway. So, yeah, I made the decision and luckily had another option. I just kind of reflected, like, if we have this chat now, do you care if I went till 32 or 35? Like, does my mom care? like no one really cares. And I don't think it means that much to me, you know. So, but it was hard, man. Super difficult. I think walking away from a career is one of the hardest things a sportsman has to do, is retire. It really is still still a mental juggling act to figure out. It's still very tough. Still so tough.
A career that involves a lot of adrenaline, right? There's a lot of adrenaline around the race, and that becomes something your body is used to and enjoys, I guess. And then suddenly that's not there, right? I think we see it a lot with athletes, certainly extreme sports athletes, like falling into drugs and things like that and finding other ways to like get a kick. Has it been a real sort of struggle to find ways to make life feel exciting for you?
I think so. I've probably, from the outside, it looks really good. As I said, it is a struggle. I was lucky to put proposals together and get backing from Scott and go straight into an ambassadorship, and as well as Crankworx asking me, even while I was still racing, to commentate. And I love commentary. I really feel in another world. That was what I was maybe born to do. And I'm not saying I'm the best. I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I really enjoy it. That's what I mean. Like, I enjoy it like I enjoyed racing down a hill. So luckily I had that to sort of bite my teeth into. Okay, I got to learn this new industry. I got to learn what to prep and how to do it. And you go live, right? It's like a race run when they count down. As you know, probably now you're the host. So when it goes 5-4, you get a bit nervous.
Yeah.
On these podcasts. So, yeah, I had that to sort of maybe distract myself and mask it for a bit, but it's always going to come back to haunt you and eat you. Is you're right. Yeah, I was going to some of these races going, dude, I would smoke these guys. Like, not the top guys, but I was like, hey, this guy's still getting away. It's like, I put me on a bike now because I still felt like I could do it or wanted to do it. And that took a few years for me now. When I'm on the side of the track or we hang out at Leger when we saw each other, dude, I'm happy as Larry to be on the side of the tape. I don't want to be in there. It's now that I'm so far withdrawn. But back to your point, I don't think it gets spoken about enough because there's sort of a grieving period you've got to go through. You've lost a part of yourself. To say that you shouldn't identify with what you do as work, I mean, that's easier said than done. I did downhill since I was, you know, at a pretty high level of racing since I was 15 and pro since I was 18. That's all I know. That's my skill set.
Yeah.
I'm a downhiller. I go to the pub at home. Oh, you're that crazy downhiller. Like, of course it stokes the ego. You'd be lying if it didn't. So, yeah, there's adrenaline. But you know what I miss the most is probably the single-minded focus on one objective.
Yeah.
You wake up, you do your training, you do your work on your mental. You're right. It's all to get better for one thing. Then when you move away, you've obviously got to earn income. That's one thing. But it's like, okay, so what do I focus on? Okay, I got this ambassador thing. Okay, but they're asking me to commentary. Someone decides it's a good idea to open a bike shop. So I do that with my brother and another partner. I got the trails. I'm like, okay. So you're sort of desperate. You just throw a bunch of shit to the wall, see what's going to stick. Then you got to figure out what to work on and how hard. Yeah, but I can see it, man. I was listening to a lot of Lance Armstrong stuff now. Like, he's showing a lot of humility with what he's gone through. Now, I'm not condoning cheating or doping, and he doesn't really either at this stage. He's pretty honest about it. But you've seen those guys like roadies, because I think they're dealing with that weird physical high that they go into with the tour.
Yeah.
And they chase that with cocaine and other bullshit. And, dude, there's guys that have had overdoses. So it's pretty gnarly. And I don't think it's spoken enough about. And there's no support structure. Like, you've lost a part of yourself. Then you've got to earn money. But you don't have a skill set. Like, hey, can you pay me for riding a bike well? No, we did pay you for riding a bike well. Now you're deciding you're not going to do that. So what's your skill set?
It's tough, eh? Because there's not like endless roles within the industry or in the media for people to step into. And there's no obvious, not necessarily an obvious career path there. I think there are a few riders that, you know, you see them do bits of commentary here and there, and you can see how that can be a future thing for them. But for most people, that's not the case, is it? There's not anything sat there waiting for them.
That's a good point. There's no roadmap. There's not a lot of options. Luckily, with the internet and testing, and as you said before we came on, I said, oh, I'm lucky to do this. You said, but you've earned it. So I have to keep hearing that, because I don't have an ambassadorship by luck. I'm grateful and honored to do it, but it's because of a proposal and ideas I put together and because of 20 years of excelling in my craft. But there's no roadmap for everyone because not everyone is going to excel at being an ambassador. Not everyone can hop in the commentary booth. Not everyone maybe can do a podcast. And because you've got to find something you kind of want to do and then sustain that. And normally that's because there's a certain passion or carrot there for you. And it can't just be money, right? We didn't start racing downhill for money.
Right.
You started racing downhill because you love the challenge and you love being on your bike. So that is a challenge. You're right. There isn't a roadmap. There's not a big support structure. Some people are not smart enough with their money. So as soon as they finish sport, they have to take a certain job out of desperation. So they haven't bought themselves enough freedom to make a decision that's maybe better for them in the long run.
Yeah.
I don't envy people retiring. And you see it in all walks of life and stuff. It comes up a lot. I like the topic. That's kind of half of my podcast. I like speaking to people that have retired. What are you doing? How do you cope with it? I went to a chat the other day. And in our country, actually yours as well, like rugby is like you're a superstar if you play for rugby. And like, you know, South Africa, I don't want to boast, but we're like probably the best team because we win the World Cup all the time. But anyway, I didn't do anything. I'm just as lucky to be born in South Africa. But what I mean is this guy's still got jobs and people, he's like working for a wealth company doing philanthropy, but it's because he was a rugby player, because he's like an icon. And everyone was asking about the Rugby World Cup and the locker room stuff, which is super interesting. And I said at the end, you're 8 years out of being a pro sportsman. How challenging was it and what have you been doing to cope? And the room kind of went, shit. It went quiet. And then he said, great question. Because I don't think enough people ask him. How is he coping with that challenge? Now he's home on the weekends. Yeah, he wants to see his family more, but he doesn't have that adrenaline, that rush, you know? And he's got to fill that void.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tricky one for sure. And unless you've got good kind of mentors and good people around you, it can be pretty tough for riders, I think. Like you say, there's never been in the sport any kind of sort of structure to help riders in their career, right? Some people are lucky they've got a good manager or a good mentor, but it's not always the case.
No, it's not always the case. And anyone listening that's gone through it or whatever, like reach out. Like I think we should normalize how difficult it is. We should normalize. People think, oh, you got your shit together. Yeah, I do, but it's a constant work to work on it. Like if I don't have projects, I don't feel like I'm doing my work. So then I feel that I'm not adding value, and that doesn't make you feel good as a person as well, even though I've got a lot going on. There'll be quiet periods. So it's certainly tough. And yeah, like I say, my door is always open because I enjoy the topic. And if I can add any value to someone's life or ask them questions that might get them further down the road to making a decision what to do, like what will fulfill them, you know? I'm always open to chat about that. And yeah, it's a fascinating topic and not spoken about enough. So thanks for bringing it up.
No, it's a pleasure, man.
I'm not looking for sympathy. Definitely not.
That's all good, man. It's all good. And I mean, you've made talking about some of this stuff part of your like ongoing career, right? You've started the podcast with Moving the Needle. Tell us a bit about that. Like where does the drive come from for that, and how are you enjoying it?
I have enjoyed it. It's an idea I had a long time ago, probably before you started yours, that I even know mountain biking podcasts exist, because I just really listen to a lot of business podcasts and self-help and, you know, the Rogans and all that stuff. When I was on the road, you got so much time. And some people listen to music, and that's great. But I listen more to podcasts and audiobooks. And it was COVID, and then Davey at the time was Hook It Podcast, now Ride Companion, had me on his. And he said, oh, you know, you've got these connections and all this insight. Why don't you start a podcast? I was like, shit, you know, I've had the idea for 10 years. I just haven't committed, haven't done it. So long story short, we started in COVID. And my goal is probably as yours. Like to me, the stories of the riders haven't been told on a long form format. And or bringing up topics that are challenging to speak about. All those songs sort of came idea, as well as connecting with people that I haven't spoken to for a while, like a Rennie.
Yeah, yeah.
I probably wouldn't phone Rennie and have a 3-hour conversation, but I have done that because the podcast did that, or EC.
Yeah.
And I had a cool chat with Nigel Page. It's coming out soon. I thought, man, he's an awesome character and he's done so much for the sport. And he was always so positive to me on the race circuit. But for sure as shit, we haven't spoken for 2 hours all in one go, you know. So it's kind of a selfish excuse to reconnect, but then hopefully add value to some people. That's where the podcast was, as well as the commentary thing. You know, I was doing a lot more. Things have changed now with Crankworx changing their broadcast team. And obviously the huge news of Discovery and all that, changing that. And I've only really been doing world champs.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I love watching the racing. I'm analytical, probably like you are. So I'm going to talk about it to you in passing or my brother on the couch when we're watching. So I was like, well, might as well be a guy on the couch shouting at the TV and giving opinions about shit, you know?
Definitely, man. So yeah, come on then. You're like super embedded in the sport. In your mind, who should we be keeping an eye on this season across the different disciplines? Different categories.
Shucks.
It's a tricky question, eh?
You've hit me just before I've done my prep for the season coming up. You might have started yours.
No, honestly, I haven't yet. Actually,
yeah,
he's going to ask me. Who do I think? But
yeah, you're like a tricky. Dangerous question because it's coming back. Shucks. So I enjoyed watching some of the race tapes because it's kind of re-jarring my memory. I don't know if you have this. I'll make notes. I'll do the review podcast. And you ask me 2 weeks later who won the race. I'm like,
that's age, mate. Know. That's age.
Yeah, it's an age. Okay,
it gets worse.
I'll use that excuse. Yeah, I'll use that excuse. But you ask me who won it in 2010 at this venue, I'm probably going to be better. Yeah, it's an age. But I was super interested to see Jackson this year, but now we're obviously not going to see him because of the knee injury.
Feels like
but
that,
to me,
to
that first year, there's a lot less expectations. But now if you get second with a flat tie in Andorra,
mm-hmm.
I mean, only one way is up. You know, everything else is certainly going to feel like you went a little bit backwards. And he even said that, you know, from here, I've got to probably aim a little bit higher. So now you've got the expectations of potential and overall. You won two races. What's the next goal? It's an overall. So you start the first race thinking about the overall. That's probably a little bit tough.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. As far as like at the top pointy end, like Amory's had such shit luck. You know, he seems healthy and strong, right? Like I say, I haven't deep dived into all the top riders, but I think hopefully Amory's going to be back.
Yeah.
Loic's going to be strong. You know, there's a question mark every year. It's like Loris. Like, is it because we all just think he's so talented that we all just put this expectation on him? And downhill racing is so difficult to get it good and get it consistent.
Yeah. Often the fastest rider on track in practice, or at least looking the fastest rider. He's so talented on a bike, but just, and he's led the overall, right? But it just doesn't quite seem to come together for him in a season yet.
No, and it's I say it about Gwyn. Like, Gwyn's a victim of his own success. When you're so good, you can't not even allowed to get second anymore. Like, it's kind of unfair, but we're bench race pundits now, so we get to just say what everyone is thinking, you know? Oh, what happened? And maybe that happens with Loris as well. He is so talented. You expect so much from him. But downhill doesn't work like that. You don't win a downhill race on paper.
Yeah.
And you don't, it's not in like tennis where you got five sets. So if you have a problem in the first two sets, like the cream will rise to the crop, to the top. Maybe in downhill by the end of the season, the cream will rise, but not in a race, right?
Mm.
Like you can, you know, if you're not quite on your game. But did you see how well Ethan did at that pre-race?
I was going to say Ethan, like we saw that.
That's Monson cool.
And run, and then we saw him beat Loic and Loris at that early season race by a fairly healthy margin on a short track as well. So, and he's analytical, very process orientated, very like he's got an older head on his shoulders, I think. So that would be interesting.
That'd be very interesting. You know, I haven't got to know him too well, but this year probably a little bit better if I sneak to some of the races, and he's obviously under the Scott Scott Tent. I'd have to literally pick the overall, and then we'd look through the top 20 riders plus some guys that got injured. Like, how difficult is it this day and age to pick sort of race winners? Andy Cole, he's coming into his own.
Yeah.
Charlie Hatton, okay, so he's done the World Champs jersey. He's kind of now had the curse breaking himself. So, like, okay, so can he bounce back? And then obviously Greg Minnaar, like, how fired up is he to go out the way he wants to go out now? You know, that's what he needs. He needs this underdog. He's got this new bike. I like when people go to a new bike, because I know from myself, it forces you to ride down your more. It forces you to get in tune with the bike. If you've got a bike for the last 10 years, you know, you can test and you can tweak, but I sometimes maybe you go through the motions a bit. But you got a new bike. You got you know, I think you're forced to really do some good work on it. And I'm just speaking from my personal experience.
Yeah.
Is when you change teams, is like an added motivation. It's like going on a holiday.
Yeah. And you know Greg will put the work in, right? That's Greg.
Yeah. So who are we missing? Who are you now that we're, like, we need to be honest with our listeners. We haven't done our prep yet, because this is just a podcast not about the full race season, but
I'm intrigued to see how Benoit gets on. I think that breakthrough result has been a while coming, and then often the confidence that comes from that drives through. I think Dakota Norton on that new Mondraker is not hanging
about.
That's
a great point.
And Ronan, to be fair, as well.
Ronan and Dakota are going to be pretty dangerous this year.
Ronan's hardline performance was pretty insane on the old bike, which he said himself is not as fast as the new bike as well.
True. Yeah, Ronan, super excited to see that. That's one of these younger crop of riders where, you know, it's kind of reminds me of Danny back in the day. And speaking of that, so yeah, Dakota, yeah, had fascinating chat to him, and I think this is just giving him more self-belief, which he's probably battled with, he said, in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think he now knows he deserves to be there. He firmly believes it. And the factory support's going to be good. Then Danny Hart, is he going to have a chip on his shoulder? Because just with the industry cycle and where we are, he's moved on from his old team. But the bike's proven, because Ethan had a great race on it. So that's actually really good for him.
Yeah.
So we just have to bring up the list and we could go through it. But it's going to be exciting. It really is. There's lots of stories going into this off season, a lot of team changes.
Like, yeah,
literally out of left field. You're like, Greg's not on Santa Cruz. Like, that, you couldn't have guessed that. In previous years, it's like, okay, two people have changed teams. Like, okay, well, you know, what are we talking about here?
No, it's exciting.
When are we going to see him back? I don't think Gwyn's back at the first race. There's no way.
He is back on back a downhill bike. Yeah, agree. I don't know whether he'll be race ready or not yet, but that would be cool to see. What about in the women's field, right? Because that's also like getting deeper and deeper with talent.
Yeah, and the juniors are getting more comfortable. Like Phoebe's sort of pushing on. Gracie Hemstreet, that's going to be so impressive. Miriam's hopefully going to be strong again and not have any issues. Although, didn't she hurt herself in Queenstown again?
Yeah, I think she's done a thumb, hand, like maybe thumb? A skier's thumb or something like that. Yeah,
yeah, okay. So she can bounce back from that. Yeah, it's going to be super interesting. Yeah, the women's field, I just don't know if we're losing some of them with this 10-rider final. That's a bit of a challenge for me.
Yeah.
But the women's field, Cammy, I mean, Valley's so dominant. Like, if we can get everyone fit, I mean, you're gonna be so stoked, because you can't really call it as well.
Yeah. Be interesting. Louise Ferguson on a new bike with a bit more support as well, like super talented rider to go up against like Gracie and Phoebe. Phoebe's been looking fast in every sort of clip I've seen in the off season as well. Like, I could see her having some good results this year. Well, not that she hasn't already had some good results, but some more podium
and
then stuff.
The more comfortable you get in the elite ranks. And with Tane, you can sort of see her really growing up as a rider. And what her role is in the industry. And I would think she's very supportive of Phoebe. It certainly seems that way.
Yeah, I get that impression.
So that's a really good thing. I don't know if there's crazy competition there. I could be wrong. But I think that's really good for Phoebe, getting taken under the wing and feeling accepted there. So she's going to be super, super good. And then Valley going back to YT, kind of like a homecoming thing. I didn't understand their launch. What was the, like, was there a goat on the beer or some animal on the beer and then they drank? Like, I didn't, maybe I'm old. I don't know. Did you? I don't know what the point was.
I think
it was like the weirdest launch video ever.
I think they just like to throw things out there, don't they? And like stand out from the crowd. They've done it in the past with Christopher Walken in the,
yes.
I think it was the Jeff C campaign. And like, yeah, they just
to be different.
Want to be different, right? Which I think it's cool. I think there's a place for that.
I don't know what the context was. So someone needs to tell me I'm old and didn't catch it. No, I respect the brand. It's cool. Those guys kill it. And that's interesting that they've got her coming back and then rebuilding that factory team. So that's going to be pretty cool. Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's just so – I mean, who are we missing? Like Bernard Kerr, is this his last hurrah? How he's been putting the work in. So you got that.
Ocean,
there's so
we
many. We're obviously
about.
Missing a few.
Yeah, Ocean we haven't mentioned.
Yeah. Chiefs breakout win as well. What does that do for conference? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man, I can't wait. It's going to be a good season, dude. Well, we should...
Where do we watch it on?
Good question. What? I think
we have okay, so you don't even know.
I think we have to get Discovery Plus in the UK. I don't know if that's the same for you guys.
True. So I got to research what exists here on a streaming platform that'll definitely have it.
Yeah. I think it's probably Discovery Plus or Max or something like that. And then I think it was the Australia and New Zealand distribution hadn't been sorted out last time I heard. But they were hoping to have something in place for the first race. But yeah, I don't know yet. We'll work that out. There's always a way, right?
Yeah, we've got a little bit of time. We've got a month. Less than a month looking at the date. Shit, yeah. Racing's happening less than a month. That's cool, eh?
It's coming around. Yeah, it's been cool. A long off-season, man. Well, we should start wrapping up. We've got our final four questions that we've asked many people over the years, so we'll hit those. The first one is, if you had £150, which I think is R3,500, to improve your performance on a bike, what would you recommend people go spend that on?
Shucks, I've heard you ask this. I didn't prep. $150 to improve their performance?
Yeah.
And what level of rider is it?
Let's
so
just
a
say
generic question, I guess.
Yeah, generic, like not a high level racer, just someone who enjoys riding, might do the occasional weekend warrior at a race, but
coaching.
Uh-huh.
Skills coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had much?
Unless I've seen his bike and I can, there's a glaring issue on the bike.
Okay. Yeah.
But if he wants to increase his performance, then I would say coaching. I don't think coaching is looked at enough in our sport. It's getting obviously more popular, but I'm talking about the everyday rider, because I've got a few hobbies and it's huge in sport of golf to go for coaching. I'm like, yeah, you need it. It's quite a technical sport, but you could argue riding is getting more technical, and if you have a better technique, it's just gonna help you in the long run, as well as it's safer if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, massively, man. All right, nice one. Second question, if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Invest in low-cost ETFs way sooner than I started. Be more outwardly appreciative of what everyone else is doing for you, because I think when you're a teenager, it comes a little later.
Mm-hmm.
So I was instilled really good morals and stuff from my parents, don't get me wrong. But that, and then, be super focused, but don't take life too seriously, because, you know, it's all going to be done pretty soon, like the career. And if you put so much pressure on yourself, you might waste a few years.
Yeah. Good advice. All right, next one. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them? And again, you've had the opportunity to ride with a lot of the world's best, but where would you head?
Oh, is this mountain bike coaching?
You could pick a mountain bike one and an out of mountain bike one if you want.
No, selfishly, I want to go get a coaching lesson from a certain golf coach, but that doesn't really help your listeners. A coaching lesson? Jeez, that's a good question. Shit. Who did you pick? Who would you pick? Maybe it'll spur some
good question.
Juices in my head.
I think I've said in the past, like Nico or Fabian, I just feel like they're so analytical about what they do. Like they really, I feel like they really understand how they perform, maybe more than some riders who are more like riding on intuition. So I think riding or having some input from either of those two would be pretty beneficial, especially for me because I'm analytical and I like to understand kind of how I'm doing stuff. So yeah, probably one of those two.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually steal that because Nico, when I was at that mega avalanche, he took one look at the bike and he said, your results are up and down, depending on the course. He took one look at the bike. And I was like, yeah, I'm literally my results. I feel like I can win one day and then I cannot even get in the top 20. So, because he just, not a lot of his information has been brought to the public, right? Someone like Greg, you can understand his thinking, PD, Fabian a little bit because he's giving it on to some of the younger riders. But yeah, Nico, on mountain biking, yeah, I would spend a day with Nico at the height of my career or just before that. That would be fascinating. So yeah, I would have to steal that from you for sure.
I'll let you have that one. All right. Last one. What do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
I drink my AG1.
Oh, come on. Such a podcaster.
I thought you might enjoy that.
Oh, dear.
I thought you might enjoy that. No,
I thought you were going to talk about shaving your balls.
We can, but I don't want to bastardize your brilliant hard work. No. Every day that you think benefits me. Shucks. I'd say the days that I read. Yeah. And exercise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would say that.
Are you a fiction or a non-fiction kind of guy when you read?
No, non-fiction, yeah.
Okay. Any particular standout like books over the last few months that you found really useful?
There's a few that are just go-tos that I would gift. I think Ego the Enemy from Ryan Holiday is a good book.
Okay.
Probably cut my career shorter because I was like, why am I chasing this weird thing down a hill to try and impress other people and compete with other people? Anyway, and then there's another book called Soul for Happy that I thought was a really brilliant read. I forget the author. I'll send it to you offline.
Okay, yeah.
But if you Google Soul for Happy, he should come up. Really fascinating guy. That's like a super smart guy that worked at Google X and he sort of reverse engineered it. But it's more like his way of looking at all these different topics. So that's pretty interesting, yeah.
Cool. Nice one. I'll stick links in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've gone through a lot of them. I just think, it's good to sort of educate yourself. And then, health is so important. Yeah, for sure. For sure. 100%. If I can get some exercise in, it's a good day.
Definitely, man. Nice. Well, it's been a lot of fun chatting to another fellow podcaster. If people want to follow you and if they want to check out the podcast, like, where are people heading?
Yeah, thanks for that, man. Yeah, so just search Moving the Needle Podcast or Moving the Needle, the Andrew Nyetling Podcast. We're on all those platforms. I started Instagram for it as well, Moving the Needle Podcast, but it mostly goes through my personal Instagram, which is at Andrew Nyetling. So, yeah, if you've got any questions, just reach out. I do reply to all of them. I do my best, depends on how many come in and if I see them, but I like engaging with it, and that's probably been the thing I'd say. Thanks to everyone that sends like a review or like takes the time to send a message. I don't know how it is with you. Because they take a lot of work. So thanks for what you're doing because you've got a hell of a lot of episodes and you're busting them out. It takes a lot of work pre and post. So thanks for sort of pushing the mountain bike industry forward. So, and thanks to the listener. Yeah, if you had any value, see you over on my podcast as well.
Nice one. Thanks, man. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'll stick all the links to all of that stuff so people can find it nice and easily in the show notes. But yeah, I look forward to listening to more of your episodes throughout the year, hopefully catch up with you at some of the races. And we'll no doubt have a very exciting season of racing ahead of us.
Peace, man.
All right, that's it for this episode with Andrew. I really hope you've enjoyed it. A massive thanks to We Are One Composites for supporting this episode. If you want to get your hands on the best riding and most robust wheels you'll ever own, then you can do so right now with 20% off all wheel sets for Downtime listeners. Just head over to wearonecomposites.com and use the code DOWNTIMEMAY20 at the checkout. That's Downtime with a capital D, May with a capital M, and the number 20 with no spaces at wearonecomposites.com until the end of May 2024. Also, a massive thank you to Wahoo. Wahoo products have been instrumental in my personal fitness over the last few years. What's more, they keep getting better with software updates, the most recent of which adds the ability to control your music from your Wahoo bike computer and shortly to control your GoPro too. So no more post-ride regrets when you realize you've not managed to press record. Check out the whole range over at wahoofitness.com. If you want to help support the podcast, that could be via a regular donation at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, by grabbing yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop, by sharing the episodes with your friends or online, or by subscribing to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast, and head there and show the videos some love with likes and comments to help the channel grow. Stay connected by following the podcast. Hit that button in your podcast app now, or visit downtimepodcast.com/follow. Don't forget to follow on Instagram and Facebook too, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And for that extra dose of downtime, you can sign up to our newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. All right, that's it for today. We're going to have another awesome episode coming up really soon. But until next time, get out and ride.